Do you have a particular form or type of exercise that you recommend for individuals who have the symptoms of Parkinson's?
I recommend that everybody keep active. Whether you have Parkinson's or not, the benefit of staying active cannot be overstated. It is it truly, the adage use it or lose it is truly applicable to the human body. And with Parkinson's, there are obvious certain challenges that come with mobility, and it's hard to ask people to use their body when something as simple as taking a step can be a chore. And so, again, you cater this to the needs of the individual and the symptoms of the individual, but I find that things that are rhythmic are very, very helpful. Bicycles are excellent, and, you know, some people ride, you know, here locally we have the Cycle to Portland ride every year, and it's impressive the number of, you know, Team Parkinson's has a huge turnout every year, and that's great. And if you're not up for rides around the neighborhood or these long bike trips, stationary bikes, recumbent bikes for people who have more advanced disease or are more elderly, those tend to be great. Certainly most people by now are familiar with some of the research on dance and Parkinson's, that that the symptoms of Parkinson's really tend to be decreased or move out of the way when one is dancing. I've had many patients say how much better they move when they can get their mind and head out of the way and just trust their body to do what needs to be done. Tai Chi is not only wonderful exercise, but it incorporates some of that rhythmic movement. It incorporates meditation, and there's a routine to it, and so you can work on the flow and really getting your head out of the way. And certainly yoga here in Seattle, we're very fortunate to have some excellent yoga teachers who specialize in Parkinson's disease. And so I would say, you know, 3-4 days a week somewhere in Seattle there is a yoga class specifically for people with Parkinson's disease, and the teachers are wonderful. Some people get pushed just like anybody else would be pushed, and other people are accommodated with chairs and bands and blocks, however they need to be accommodated. But everybody walks out feeling like they've gotten something out of it. So I look forward to more cities around the country and around the world being able to offer classes that cater to individuals' needs like that.
Dr. Mishley, you have just released a book that has a most engaging title, Natural Therapies for Parkinson's Disease. Tell us all about your book.
Well, the book was born out of, you know, there's only so many patients one can see in the course of a week, and the number of people calling looking for this information exceeded what I was able to hand out. And so what started out as a few handouts that I was giving out to people at lectures and presentations, I found myself repeating a lot of the same information and people clearly asking for me to repeat it and tell them more. And so what I have basically done is taken what I tell my patients, you know, hour after hour here in the clinic, what we walk through when people ask about coenzyme Q10, I've laid the book out in a question-answer format so that what I'm basically doing is the entire book, I'm answering patients' questions. I'm telling them when they ask a question, how does this work? Why would I use this? Is it worth the cost? Do I need a special brand? What I do is question by question, I go through and I answer the questions, and that's ultimately what's been published. What I've done too at the end that I think has probably been very helpful for people is the science of alternative medicine is really evolving, and so people don't know how to compartmentalize it, how to think about it, how it fits with conventional medicine. I've devoted some chapters to what do you need to tell your conventional doctor, what if your doctor is not supportive of you being on alternative therapies, are there any drug-nutrient interactions that you need to be concerned about. I've covered all of those chapters, but the other thing that I've done is help people really cognitively get a grasp of what it is that we're talking about here with alternative medicine. So often people will come in and they're on a list of 20 things and they honestly can't even remember why they're on some of what they're on. Somebody, they read someplace that this might help, and somebody's sister told them to take a little bit of this. And so what I really encourage people to do is claim the situation and get control over their own health care. Why are you on what you're on? What are we trying to accomplish? How can we evaluate if it's working or not? At what point do we know that we're on the right track? And so at the end of the book, I've summarized the entire book in basically one chart that breaks up our goals, my goals for treating my patients with Parkinson's disease. Is not just this decrease the symptoms of Parkinson's. It's a very small part of what we're trying to do. What I've done is there's an entire section on here are the nutrients and supplements and foods and things that I recommend if your goal is to encourage the function of your brain and to protect your neurons from cell death. And there are very specific recommendations to that end. If your goal is symptom management, my doctor's telling me my disease has progressed enough that I now should start levodopa. I really, really don't want to start levodopa for these reasons. Is there anything else? Yes, there are natural herbs, plants, that contain levodopa, and they're quite effective. Here, if your goal is symptom management with Parkinson's, consider these alternative therapies or natural therapies. If patients come in and their goal is they're having a lot of on-offs, they've been on levodopa for 10 years and they're getting to that point where the medicine works for them sometimes and betrays them other times, and they're sick of the on-off and unreliability of their conventional medicine, there are nutrients and things that you can do that will actually allow you to effectively reduce your dose of levodopa without losing the efficacy. And so depending on, and then there's another section that outlines how to reduce medication side effects. If your goal, you get nauseous, you, again, back to the on-offs, you have dyskinesias from your medications, here are a couple things that you can do that will accomplish that goal. And so what I've tried to do is make it so that, there are probably 50 different natural therapies that have been chapter by chapter laid out. What I've tried to do at the end is make it so that people have a cheat sheet to help them hone in on what exactly are you trying to accomplish here. Are there things that everybody with a diagnosis of Parkinson's should be on, or are there things that you just don't need? At some point, they may be useful. They may be useful for your friend or your neighbor, but they're not at all applicable for you, and they would be a waste of your time and money. And so I've tried to make that easy for people at the end. And then the other thing that I've tried to do as much as possible is set it up as a reference manual so that it is not a book that you need to sit down and read cover to cover. If somebody asks you, do you take green tea? Are you on citicoline? Do you take glutathione or alpha-lipoic acid? And you don't know the first thing about alpha-lipoic acid. You don't know what it is or why you would take it. You can, neurologists or patients, or family members can open up to the page on alpha-lipoic acid and very quickly get an overview. What is it? Where does it come from? What does the research say about Parkinson's disease and lipoic acid? Might I want to take it? What dose? And where might I get it from? And so I've tried to make it as much as possible an easy read, a reference manual. Where possible, I've included little boxes for your physicians where people who might want a little more science, they want to understand the mechanism by which some of these things are working. I've included boxes set off to the side that the lay population can ignore if they want to ignore it, or people who have a better understanding of science and neuropathology can get a little more information if they want it. And so as much as possible, it's a reference. I tried to make it an easy read and is increase the utility of the book as much as I was able to.
At least 99% of the people who are listening to this discussion of your new book, Natural Therapies for Parkinson's Disease, or at this point want to know the answer to the question, how can I buy your book?
Amazon. Amazon. It's on Amazon. I worked with a local publisher, Coffeetown Press, who has been absolutely wonderful to work with. And you can either get it through the Coffeetown Press website or Amazon, whichever is more convenient.
And the title of the book again is Natural Therapies for Parkinson's Disease. What does it take, in your opinion, for a person with Parkinson's to begin getting sustained relief from their symptoms?
A commitment to a certain lifestyle, truly. One of the things that is covered in the book is how we eat and the nutritional and dietary components of Parkinson's disease. And what we know is that there really is a way to eat that is protective against Parkinson's and most other neurologic disorders, and that there's a way to eat that lends to the development of certain neurologic diseases. And so, you know, one example of this is carbohydrates. You know, we in America tend to have affinity for pasta and bagels and breads, and it's a cultural norm to have a pastry for breakfast and a sandwich for lunch and pasta for dinner, and that's not the way to encourage neurologic health for the long run. And so those, you know, most people are okay taking a couple pills or supplements here and there. That tends to be pretty easy. People are motivated, they hate the disease, they want to do what they can. And taking a supplement or two here or there, a little bit of fish oil, that's easy for patients. What's difficult are the lifestyle changes that require grocery shopping to be different, meals to be different. It affects your partner and your kids what I try to do is talk to people about how to be moderate. You know, you don't need to take anything to extremes. It doesn't mean you can never have a sandwich or a pastry or a pasta again. But how do you make that shift so that what was your norm 2 years ago is not going to be your norm 2 years from now? And how do you slowly make that change? And the dietary changes, the nutritional changes, are the ones that are most difficult for patients. I also think they're the ones that are the most fruitful. And the patients who I think really do the best are the people who come in with an open mind and say, what do I need to do to make this disease not take over my life? Those are the people who 5 and 10 years later are actually doing really, really well.
You've had an eloquent explanation of carbohydrates. Is it okay for people to have an ice cream every day?
No, it's not. So there have been 3 studies done that are called prospective observational studies. They're epidemiologic studies, which means we don't study people with Parkinson's and look backwards. What happens is studying food and disease is really difficult. If you take a group of people with Parkinson's, say we take 100 people with Parkinson's, and we say, what do you eat? We know, it's not just Parkinson's, for any disease, people inaccurately report what they eat. They don't realize that there was a tablespoon of butter in that croissant that they had this morning. They don't realize that there was egg in their whatever. And so it's really, really hard to have people report accurately what they're eating. It gets even more difficult if you say, what were you eating a year ago? What were you eating 5 years ago? How many servings of ice cream did you have 15 years ago? And so what happens is when you take a disease and look backwards, the further back you look, the more inaccurate the data becomes. And so when we really want to study, are there ways to eat, are there things that people do that increase or decrease their risk of developing Parkinson's, from a research perspective, the best way to do that is something called a prospective study, where you take thousands of people in the population who are young, they're healthy, and everybody, a couple times a year, sits down and says, this is exactly what I have for breakfast, this is exactly what I have for lunch, these are my snacks, these are my dinners, this is my ice cream snack, this is my soda consumption. And we get to fall. And so periodically people commit to filling out these forms for 20, 30 years. And so what researchers are then able to do is very accurately say, hey, people who did this in their 20s have an increased or decreased risk of developing this disease in their 50s or 60s. And so those studies are obviously very expensive. They're very difficult to do. They require tens of thousands of people. The Nurses' Health Study is one of them. The Physicians' Follow-Up Study is another. There was one called the Hawaiian Health Study. Those are the three that have looked at nutrition and Parkinson's disease. All of them had thousands and thousands of people in the studies. But those three studies have all asked the question, is there anything that people are eating early in life or throughout their life that increases their risk of developing Parkinson's disease? And interestingly, all three of those studies came up with one food and one food only, and it was dairy. All three studies said the more dairy an individual eats over the course of their life, the more likely he or she is to develop Parkinson's disease. The correlation was stronger for men than it was for women, but nobody's really studied this. We don't know what this means. We don't know why. There are a bunch of theories. Dairy certainly tends to be a very constipating food. People are asking, could there be a toxin in the dairy, that a neurotoxin? I mean, we just don't know. People are throwing out ideas, but nobody has really gone back and said, hey, three for three studies have drawn a link between dairy consumption and Parkinson's. Why is this? What could this be? And so that's where we're at. That's all we know, is that those three studies say what I just told you, and no one's really sure what to do with that information. There's never been a single study done that says if you have Parkinson's disease and you take it out, it'll change the course of your disease. And it's not that it will or it won't. We don't know. The study has never been done. Nobody has ever asked that question and studied outcomes. And so right now people are kind of forced to make a decision. Do I wait until the study is done? Do I wait until a couple scientists someplace decide to tackle this research question, and I'm going to keep eating ice cream every single day until they have an answer for me? Or, hey, ice cream is good, but it's not that good, you know. I'm gonna switch over to sorbet. And so when we say dairy, you know, just for people who aren't familiar with what exactly that means, dairy, we're talking milk, cream, butter, cheese, yogurt, sour cream, cottage cheese, ice cream are probably America's most frequently consumed sources of dairy.
All the food that people really love to eat.
Right. Well, you know, right. And so when you were saying what lifestyle changes or what changes do people make that lends to success here, you know, we just talked about the excess consumption of carbohydrates. And now we're talking about this link between dairy and Parkinson's disease. It is a major lifestyle change for people to curb their dairy and carbohydrate consumption. And so, but the flip side to that is what is left are fruits, vegetables, meat, beans, legumes, fish. I mean, you end up filling your stomach with foods that tend to be much, much more nutrient dense, have much more to offer. I mean, a bowl of ice cream and a grilled cheese does not have a lot of nutrition behind it. And so if you take those foods out, you have no choice but to fill it up with, you know, rice and chili and fish and broccoli and some of the better foods. And so, you know, we accomplish two things. We take out things that are potentially harmful, but you replace it with things that actually have some medicinal value behind them. So we don't know, is the benefit from taking the carbohydrates and dairy out, or is the benefit from what you replace it with? We don't know. This all needs to be studied yet.
As you mentioned, too, there are alternatives to dairy, for example, sorbet and many other products that do not use dairy ingredients, but they taste a lot like dairy.
Oh, sure. I mean, I'm speaking from Seattle. And so I realize that that's not, most people around the country do not have the luxury that we have here. I have labeled us the elitist food capital of the world. And you can walk into Fred Meyer and have an entire six-aisle section of health foods to choose from, most of which are dairy-free. It's really, really easy to eat the way I'm suggesting you eat here in Seattle. I grew up in northern Michigan. I go back to Michigan for a few weeks every year, and it's not that easy. It is not that easy to get alternatives. And so what you need to do is really, really approach this slowly and be what I emphasize is you make these changes in a slow, sustainable way. I don't want anybody doing a radical dietary shift overnight. You know, what ends up happening is people live off chips and salsa for the next month, and then they get annoyed with the diet and the restrictions in me, and the pendulum swings, and they eat three tubs of ice cream, and it doesn't work like that. And so what I have people do is, don't create extra drama here. Realize you've been eating this way for the last 60 years. It doesn't need to change right now, today. But what you can do today is go walk through the aisles of the grocery store and just make a list of some of the things that you enjoy that don't have extra carbohydrates and dairy in them. You know, and that might be chili I listed earlier. Oatmeal for breakfast is excellent. A lot of people lox, eggs, scrambled eggs for breakfast. You know, most meals around our house are, you know, a grain, some rice, you know, fish, poultry for dinner with some vegetables. That's not an uncommon dinner for most people. Somebody came out with, Michael Pollan came out with a wonderful book a couple months ago called Food Rules. And they're just simple rules to eating. And they're not that different than the ones that I'm suggesting here, but one of his rules is, if your great-grandmother wouldn't recognize the food, don't eat it. And so, you know, I think that's an easy way, it's an easy way to eat if you just stick to whole foods. You know, oh, carrots, I know those come from the ground, that's familiar to me. Let's have carrots with your chicken and rice. And so you do not need to be as limiting as one would imagine, but I do encourage people to, first and foremost, increase the list of foods that you like. Expand your repertoire of foods that you already eat and that you enjoy, that do not have dairy in them, or you know, a whole or excessive carbohydrates, and then slowly start trying more and more things. I mean, most cultures outside of Western Europe and America eat the way I'm suggesting people eat. And so what I will often do is, you know, send people to, most Mediterranean food works. I'll send people out to the Ethiopian restaurant to get legumes, and teff is a different grain. And so, again, we have the luxury here of being able to choose your country of origin and go see what foods people eat there. And so I will often direct people to cookbooks from South America and Africa and Mediterranean region, and really get more legumes in the diet, more beans, more vegetables, different, you know, meat that is not the same, you know, two or three types of meat that people eat here, but, you know, expand the options. Expand the diversity of what you eat is a better strategy than just depriving yourself of the things that you can't have.
Many people have questions about the direction that research has taken with regard to Parkinson's disease. Researchers are obviously looking at all kinds of issues in all kinds of ways. Could you comment on what's happening out there with regard to research?
Sure, I'd love to. This is an area I'm very much active in and interested in. And I am absolutely inspired by what is happening in research today. I'm inspired by the funding dollars that are available to do research, the true, sincere enthusiasm of the researchers about getting closer and looking for ways to curb the onset of this disease, the progression of this disease. As an alternative medicine provider, as a naturopathic doctor, you know, I've come into the to conventional research in Parkinson's disease from quote-unquote outside the box, and it has been, my experience has been nothing but positive, the degree to which researchers have invited me to be a part of research meetings and events. Everyone truly wants to hear what all of the players have to say. Everyone's open to new ideas. At least here in Seattle, I've had a wonderful time building collaborative relationships with other Parkinson's disease researchers, whether they're geneticists or dementia, specializing in dementia or specializing in movement disorders, or whether they're pathologists or clinicians. I can't get over how welcoming new ideas and creative thoughts have been for Parkinson's disease researchers. I think that what's happening in the research world, not only is there a evolving spirit of collaboration and open-mindedness that was not around a decade ago, But people are starting to take a slightly different strategy to Parkinson's disease. I think that whereas we used to think of this as minute little problems in the neurons. Oh, look, here's the formation of Lewy bodies. Oh, look at the formation of free radicals. I think that everybody is getting a little bit wiser and stepping back and realizing that it's really easy in research to lose sight of the big picture where you can't see the forest for the trees. And so people are all starting to take a step back and look at the brain and Parkinson's disease as a whole in a much more holistic manner. People are talking, researchers around the world are starting to get away from the minute details of, you know, proteins X, Y, and Z building up, gene A, B, or C being present, and starting to look at gene environment interactions is an evolving field of research. Just because you're born with a certain gene certainly does not mean that you are going to develop Parkinson's. What we know is that if you have a certain gene, there are environmental triggers that can get put the disease in motion. And so more and more researchers are starting to appreciate that there is not going to be a single bullet that solves this problem. And so the only way that we're truly going to move forward is for the people who study environmental medicine to be working hand in hand with the people who study genetics. And so, again, we're seeing greater collaborations. Even on a national level, we're seeing a greater call for research that emphasizes what is truly a little bit more holistic. I mean, how do you improve the function of the brain? We know that people with Parkinson's disease will slowly start to lose cells in the substantia nigra. It's not just about what's killing them. I think there are two parts to this, and more and more researchers are being asked to consider what can we do to make cells of our brain more resilient so that the insults that we all face, or especially people with Parkinson's face, their brains are not as susceptible to damage. And so it's really a change in research from the last couple decades to shift our focus, not from, you know, who's the bad guy, how do we stop it, but hey, how do we work together to change our understanding of this disease? How do we improve the function of the brain? How do we get mitochondria to function better so that they're producing more energy, improving cell survival, improving what are some of the things that we do in our lifestyles that confer neuroprotection, be that melatonin at night when we sleep or estrogen? And so more people are putting their heads together in collaborative ways that I think that research in the next decade is going to transcend anything we have seen over the last couple generations.
That's exciting. What would you say to a person who has just been diagnosed with Parkinson's disease?
I would make sure that they understand the degree to which they have control over this disease and how this disease plays out. I think I mentioned earlier that, you know, one of my pet peeves here is how quick, you know, when you open up a neurology textbook on Parkinson's disease, the opening sentence is usually something like, Parkinson's disease is an irreversible progressive disease. And we don't even know what this disease is. We don't know what causes it. There are people who were diagnosed a decade ago who haven't progressed at all. They have a mild tremor that doesn't interfere with their life, and they've barely progressed or haven't progressed even without alternative therapies, natural therapies. And there are people who are in a wheelchair 3 years after their diagnosis. The diversity of this disease is not the luck of the draw. I mean, people have to realize that they've been dealt a hand of cards. It's completely up to them how they play them. And there is so much control over how you play your hand of cards. The way you eat, the way you sleep, who you sleep with, under what conditions, the amount of stress in your life, whether you choose to retire or keep going. I mean, there is no one right set of decisions for everybody, but people have to realize that they have a tremendous amount of control over how this disease is going to play out.
Do you take new patients, Dr. Mishley?
Rarely, rarely. Because I've been putting my energy into research lately, I'm not really taking new patients. What will happen is I will take approximately two to three new patients a month. They only patients with Parkinson's disease. But it's kind of a luck of the draw in terms of when I'm able to do that with my schedule. What I'm trying to focus on is taking care of the patients I currently have to the best of my ability and putting my energy into research right now. We have two excellent providers in this office, Dr. Chris Holder and Marco Vespignani, who are also both naturopathic physicians who specialize in neurology, both of whom know Parkinson's exceptionally well. And what we do is they do take new patients. They're seeing people. And so what happens is every week we get together and we talk about everybody that we're seeing. And so what patients truly get is three brains working on their case. Hey, is there something I'm not considering for Bob? Sally is asking about this. And so what we're all doing is pitching in to take care of our patients together with our weekly meetings. And so I'm not taking new patients, but there are a couple of practitioners at my clinic who are very much in line with the things that I'm talking about here today and are taking new patients.
That's an incredible approach to being able to help people. I must say, most people go to a physician and that's it. They get to see them and they leave and it's over. But in your case, it's an ongoing kind of a discussion to be able to help the person really get to a place where they're feeling a great deal better.
Thanks. We do what we can.
What is your website? Do you have a website? How do people get to it?
We do. It's seattleintegrativemedicine.com. Integrative with a Z is the clinic website. I have a personal website, is laurimishley.com, which is more just the reason to go to my personal website is simply to find out what my lecture schedule is, or you know, what are the studies that I'm working on that I might be recruiting for. But the clinic website is where you're going to find out the most about clinical care available to people with Parkinson's disease.
You better spell the Lori Mishley website address for people.
Okay, it's www.laurimishley.com.
I want to ask you again, people are now thinking, I really need to buy this book. How do they buy Natural Therapies for Parkinson's Disease?
I would encourage them to go to Amazon.com, and you can either type in my last name, Mishley, or you can type in Natural Therapies for Parkinson's Disease. And either one will bring you directly to the book, which is also available on Kindle.
And if a person doesn't have a computer but they want to order the book, is there a phone number to call or a way to get that that doesn't rely on computer access?
Sure. You can call the clinic. It's 206-525-8012, and we can send you a copy.
What question have not I asked that I should have asked you, Dr. Mishley?
That's a great question. You know, I think the question that gets asked most common here in clinic that we haven't addressed is how to address the changing face of complementary medicine in America in 2010. You know, we now know that over 50% of Americans and over 60% of people with Parkinson's disease routinely already use some form of alternative therapy, natural therapy. And what happens is there isn't a resource for many people, especially in some of the central states, where, and again, as we talked about, naturopathic physicians are not licensed in every state. And so people are kind of left to rely on the insight from the health food store clerk for what to take and when, and you have to be a pretty internet savvy you need to be pretty internet savvy to find reliable information online. It's there, but you have to know how to filter out what is junk and what is worth following up on. I think that people with Parkinson's disease are often on a limited budget, and you know, most of these therapies are not covered by insurance. Many alternative medicine providers are not covered by Medicare. And so there's this very real problem about resources and not having resources for good information, not having resources for to filter through what is and is not worth following up on, not having somebody to advise on what do I need to tell my doctor, what if my doctor's not supportive, my conventional doctor is not supportive of alternative medicine. And so these are, I just wanted to acknowledge that people often feel intimidated by their conventional doctors. They're nervous about how to bring this topic up. And I think that I just wanted to let people know that I have been witness to a changing face of alternative medicine use here in Seattle in the last decade. And a decade ago, I do think that many, if not most, neurologists would roll their eyes at complementary and alternative medicine use for Parkinson's disease a little bit. And what has happened is year by year, that has really changed, so much so that, you know, I am now routinely getting emails and phone calls from other docs saying, hey, can you show me how to prescribe this? I have a patient who's interested in this. What do you think? And I'm prescribing more conventional therapies. Conventional practitioners are prescribing more alternative therapies. We're going to the same meetings. We're getting together and sharing ideas more often. And I think that people just need to understand that money does not need to stand in your way of using some of these therapies. I mean, when you grocery shop, you are deciding how to treat your Parkinson's disease. So you don't have to be rich to use alternative therapies. You don't have to be a eccentric to use alternative medicine. What's happening is this slow, steady shift towards collaborative approach to the disease that has really been a pleasure to be a part of and to witness. And so letting people know that it is not either or. You don't need to pick sides. You don't have to decide, you know, I'm going the conventional route or the alternative route. It's not like that anymore. And what we're really trying to figure out is how to make the best of your situation and the best of what all different practitioners have to offer. How does the patient choose what's best for them?
You have offered so many incredible ideas about what individuals can do to get relief from their symptoms. What is the one thing from this discussion, from this interview, you would most like people to remember?
I think the least expensive and perhaps one of the most effective things people can do is the dietary change. Stop eating unnecessary carbohydrates. If you're not hungry, don't eat. You know, if you're overweight, if you have extra belly fat, change that. Limit dairy consumption and limit the consumption of unnecessary carbohydrates. And again, more detail is provided on how to do that and what that means in the book. It's very succinct and it's really easy to do. It doesn't need to be drastic. But if you're, you know, it's after dinner, you're not really hungry, you're looking for a little snack, instead of opening a bag of chips or pretzels, go grab an apple. Go grab some nuts. Go, you know, there are so many things that have nutrients and are healthy that you can snack on than things that take up space in your stomach and provide no nutrition. And those little teeny changes that are ultimately coming down to decisions you make 3 and 4 and 7 times a day are the ones that are going to make or break how this disease progresses.
The one thing from this interview that I want people to remember is, if you really want to get relief from your symptoms, buy Dr. Laurie Mishley's book, Natural Therapies for Parkinson's Disease. It's full of incredible ideas, suggestions for what you can do as a function of what's going on in your body. You can get it at Amazon. It's a groundbreaking work, and I want everyone who's really serious about this to go out and get a copy today. Dr. Meschly, thank you so much for being with us and for giving us such incredible insights about what individuals with the symptoms of Parkinson's can do to get relief from their symptoms.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you again very much for the invitation to participate.